Richie?
Piggott.
Piggott?
Yep.
Okay, and where are you from, Richie?
I'm from Cove, County Cork.
Oh, really?
Where all of the immigrants left from.
Yes. Yeah. And when did you arrive here?
I came here in 97. I'm here exactly 25 years.
25 years?
Yeah.
Are you here longer than you were there?
No.
No?
Not by a mile. Not by a mile. No, I'm a food scientist.
You're a food scientist.
I'm a food scientist. I did science in University College Cork and genetics in University College or Trinity College in Dublin. And
really
then
easy stuff.
I joined a small company, Irish company that was
Kerry Foods.
Well,
We're getting there.
But no, that wasn't Kerry Foods. It was a small Irish company called Biocon. It was a privately owned company.
What were you doing there for them?
I was in research and development.
Okay.
We were producing enzymes for the food industry.
Enzymes for the food industry. Yeah, that sounds really frightening.
No, not at all. It's all natural, all good.
Enzymes are in everything, right?
Oh, absolutely. Every single thing. They're in you and me. We couldn't live without them.
That's right. We're just feeding our own bodies with our own stuff.
Exactly. So that was acquired by a multinational called Unilever.
I
traveled the world with Unilever.
Doing
literally
what?
All over the world.
As a scientist, what
as
were
a scientist,
you doing?
Visiting customers, visiting the Unilever research labs all over the world.
So you're a scientist, but they have you out visiting customers?
Oh, absolutely.
Doing what? Just explaining what your product
explaining
is?
Explaining what the product is, how it works, the benefits of it, how they can use it in the production of their foods.
So you were, would you say, well, you said research and development, so you were developing products.
Initially, just in the lab, yeah. But by the time Unilever took us over, I was spending more time out
in the field.
In the field, but bringing the information back into the labs then, so I was kind of in between.
And were you also getting some information on what they were looking for?
Oh,
like
absolutely.
What they wished was out there?
Absolutely. And that was a critical part of my role, because I had to bring the want back into the lab to make sure that what was being produced or developed for them was what they needed, you know. So that was part of the role.
What an interesting career.
Yeah,
I'm learning all kinds of interesting careers during these little interviews. I have to tell you.
Good.
Yeah, I am.
So because of that, I travel literally all over the world. I've been to all over South America, all over the United States, all over Europe, all over Asia, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, Tasmania, you name it.
Developed countries.
I've been there. No, Africa. I've been to Africa and quite a few.
What were you doing in Africa?
Developing countries. And there they were looking at, for example, how to make beer, but with their raw materials as opposed to just barley and wheat.
Oh, and is there a way to do it?
Oh, there is. And we worked with them with enzymes to help them make the beer.
No kidding.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And then before 97, I'd be coming more and more over to the US. The customers liked to, when is Richie going to come over again? So 96, I was actually over here 12 months of the year.
12?
Every month of 96 I came over here.
Really?
So then they approached me at the end of the year and said, look, it'll be much cheaper to actually move you over then. So that's why, let me turn
how
this
does your off. Family feel about that?
Well, actually it was at that time I had a wife and two children, mm-hmm. who had never been to the US. I obviously had been to the US many, many times and really enjoyed it. So actually what I said to them was, look, I'm not against the idea, but what I would like to do is to have a trial run of, say, 3 months where my family and I got together here in the US to see how they felt. It was here in Chicago.
No kidding. So you came to Chicago.
Came to Chicago.
Did you come in the winter?
No, we came in, when did we come? No, it was the fall. It was actually the fall. Oh, it wasn't too
very
bad.
Pretty time of year.
Yeah, it was really nice. And after 2 or 3 weeks, everyone had decided, they loved the place.
And how old were your children at that time?
9 and 10, a boy and a girl.
Okay.
Yeah.
So good ages, really, for moving.
Oh, yeah.
To move.
Yeah. So we moved, and we moved in January, or in actually December.
Officially.
Which was a good idea. We were going to spend Christmas in Ireland, but then I thought it would be a sad time in Ireland, and then, a sad time for the kids, but... at that time, 25 years ago in Ireland, there was no, like the lights that are all outside.
It wasn't
outside.
Like Christmas here.
Big difference. So I knew the kids would find it fascinating to be here for Christmas, and
absolutely.
That would be a distraction as well.
Yeah.
So that's why we moved before Christmas. So I'm here since 97. And that company, the food ingredient division of that company, was acquired by Kerry in 2004. So I'm 18 years with Kerry. And I mean, I knew all the Kerry guys. So it was a fantastic, personally, it was a fantastic acquisition for me as well.
Who knows? Maybe they bought it because of you.
I don't know. But
That could have been the deciding factor.
So it was great because then I was going back to Ireland a lot more often than I had been before that.
Isn't that interesting? So now you're doing the reverse commute.
Yeah, so now I go back, you know, at least two or three times a year, which is great, you know.
Because Kerry is based in Ireland.
They're based in Ireland, yeah. But they're all over the world.
I'm sure you know where they have their...
Oh, yeah.
their places. Yeah. And what do you do for Kerry Foods then?
I actually run the enzyme business now here for North America and South America for Kerry.
Really?
For the food division, yeah.
Wow.
So all the different applications, you know, brewing, baking, dairy, every application. So it keeps me busy.
It's interesting that you've ended up in the food industry with your training. Well, I mean, as a chemist, obviously, but...
Well, no, my training was actually microbiology and biochemistry, and it was more on the enzyme side. So,
was it?
Yeah, so it fitted nicely.
Did you know that you were going to end up doing
that? No, not at that time, no.
You just...
Yeah, but I liked science. I always liked science, so I knew I was going to do something scientific, but what? I didn't really know, but it was a great opportunity, so I took it, you know.
Well, you're a social scientist, if you will.
Yeah.
Now, we're talking to you, Richie, because we're at IBAM. Which
yes.
is Irish Books, Arts, and Music.
Music.
No science listed in there.
No.
But in front of me, I have this beautiful, I don't even know how big this is. This is a huge book that you've done.
Yes.
It's called Cry of a People Gone.
Correct.
Irish Musicians in Chicago, 1920 to 2020. And did you choose that span of time because it was pleasing or?
No. I'll tell you how it happened. I mean, first of all, I had absolutely no intention of writing a book. But I love Irish music. I come from a very musical family.
A musical scientist as well.
A musical scientist, yeah. I grew up in a house full of music. Actually, my brother is a professional musician. You might actually know of him, Charlie Biggott, my brother. He was one of the founding members of De Danann and traveled all over.
Crazy.
And he's still a professional musician
today. Your parents must have been chuffed with you, but they got everything.
Yeah, so I loved Irish music, although I don't play Irish music. A lot of people think I do, but I don't. But I absolutely love Irish music. But I was always more interested in the history of Irish music and the social history of the musicians who played Irish music. And, you know, how they learned the music, who taught them, the tunes themselves, where did the names come from. That was always my bent rather than actually playing the music.
So you're a musical historian, sort of.
Sort of, yeah.
And Irish musical historian.
Irish music. Oh, yeah, it was always traditional Irish music. So even from, like, the age of 10, I started collecting books on Irish music, manuscripts. I have a massive library of books and manuscripts and all sorts of material related to Irish music all my life, you know. So when I came here...
To Chicago, I obviously
knew the importance of Chicago to Irish
Francis
music.
O'Neill.
Francis O'Neill and all of that. The story of the book happened on a chance evening I spent in a pub, which is a typical Irish beginning. But it's the pub was Lanigan's on the south side. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know it.
Mm-hmm.
But there were a group of older musicians went there every Sunday night, and not to play for an audience, just to play for themselves.
A session.
Mm-hmm. And I fell in, I was only one of three that particular night that I first met them, and they were playing in Lanigan's, and I was absolutely blown away by them, because not alone the music, but, you know, if there was a lull in the music, someone would recite a poem, or someone would sing a song, or even someone started telling a story. So the whole night was just so beautiful, and it was all natural. No one was saying, you know, Siobhan, you sing us. You know, it just happened. It just beautiful flow.
Very organic.
Know? Very, very organic.
And one of those things where you almost feel like a voyeur because they're entertaining themselves.
Exactly.
You just
exactly.
happen to be there.
And I found out that night that they do this every Sunday night, just for themselves, you know. So I was driving home. I live in St. Charles, which was a good drive home.
That's
good
long
drive
quite a home. Distance from Lanigan's.
Yeah, so, but they were in my head all that night and all of the following week. And I felt driven to come back.
Compelled
the next Sunday night and do the same thing. But this time I wanted to ask each of them individually, which I did, would they mind if I interviewed them about their life? How did they get here? How did they learn the music? Why Chicago? And all of them, thankfully, at the end, agreed, but initially were quite reluctant, but they were so humble, you know, they were like, who
they don't want to brag about themselves.
Yeah, who would
nobody cares
to,
about us.
Who would want to know about me? Yeah, yeah. That was the reply I was getting.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? So
we're not interesting
anyway,
at all.
I persisted, thankfully, yeah. And they all agreed. And so I interviewed them in their homes. And what happened was, two things happened. One was, there was about 12 of them, and they all came just after World War II. So they were all here since either the late 40s or very early 50s.
What year was this that you did this?
I started almost 10 years ago,
okay.
10 years ago now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So late 2011, 2012 is when I started. And as I say, and like there was no intention of writing a book at all, I felt compelled to capture their story.
To write it down.
Yeah.
Before it was lost.
Exactly. That's what was driving me to do it.
Yeah.
So
and these were all older gentlemen, obviously.
Oh yeah, they were all like the youngest was probably mid-70s, mm-hmm. and the eldest was probably mid to late 80s.
Good thing that you
exactly
the time.
Exactly. So two things, as I say, happened. One was as they were talking and as I was interviewing them. They introduced me to other musicians of their age,
right.
who were not playing in the pub, but
right.
you know they knew in both the south side and the north side. So the net widened. And the second thing that happened was nearly all of them, during the interviewing process, kept referring back to the musicians who were here when they came in the late 40s. So they were
their inspiration.
Their inspiration.
Their
exactly.
mentors.
Exactly.
Their muses.
Exactly. And that's another generation or two older than the people I was actually interviewing. So then I got interested in that group. So these were musicians who came.
But they're gone, though.
Oh, they were all gone. Every one of them were gone.
But their family's still here.
Their families are still here. And that's what got me interested in them, and that's what drew me back to the 19. We all came just after the Civil War in Ireland, you know, so the mid to late 1920s. So that's why the book is
starts in the 1920s.
Yeah. And the other reason, I mean, it fitted nicely with the interviewing process. Yeah, exactly. But the other reason was, I didn't want to, when I decided to write a book, I couldn't ignore O'Neill. Because you can't write or talk about Irish music in Chicago and not mention Francis O'Neill, but he's so well covered, you know, in programs and books, and so I didn't want to kind of rehash the whole story. But O'Neill had two collaborators in the collection of his books. He couldn't transcribe music, but James O'Neill and Selina O'Neill, none of them were related to each other. They were the two transcribers
that
of
went
all
along
his.
With them as he
exactly.
convinced people to give up the tunes.
Exactly. And Francis O'Neill was well covered, or is well covered. James O'Neill is well covered. Quivian MacKay wrote a wonderful book on the life of James O'Neill. But Selina O'Neill was
because
always
she
just
was female.
Yeah, well, she maybe
Richie.
Yeah.
Say it.
She was female.
There you go.
She was always just mentioned, Selina O'Neill. So
as
I decided.
So I decided
I'm going to start.
I like you better already, Richie. Not that I didn't like you before, but now I really like you.
So I started with Selina, and I traced her family, and actually her family are still living here in Chicago.
No kidding.
Yeah, Selina had a brother called John.
And was she originally from Ireland, or was she Irish-American?
No, she was Irish-American.
Okay.
Her father was from Brusna in County Kerry, and her mother was from Corbo in County Roscommon.
And did they come out during famine times?
Oh, no, later. It was after the famine, definitely. But they married here.
Okay.
And
she came out young then.
Yeah, and she was born here. So that's really, I started with her. I traced...
Does her family know, I beg your pardon,
sure.
Does her family know the impact that she's had on Irish boot?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
They knew.
Oh, they sure
but nobody
did.
Else knew.
Yeah, no, exactly, because when I eventually tracked down the family, it was John, her brother's descendants, I tracked down. He was, I think, the great-grandson of John. Was it the grandson? No, I think it was the great-grandson of John, who was Selena's brother. And when I...
Her grandnephew or whatever.
Yeah, her grandnephew, exactly,
yes.
Exactly. So when I contacted him, I told him what I was doing, and he was quite interested. And I said, I'd love to meet you to just talk about... And this is the kind of reaction I was getting from everyone around that time was, well, I don't play any music. So they thought I wanted... You know, I said, no, that's okay. It's more, you know, the family relationship in that
right.
The history.
I want the family lore.
Exactly.
Tell me what
so
you
he said,
know.
Oh, come along. And when I went into the house, he brought me into his living room, and there was a glass case with O'Neill's books, her fiddle, you know,
oh,
I mean,
amazing.
Oh my God. So it was like walking into a shrine of Selena.
Absolutely.
You know? So
you contacted the right person.
Absolutely.
Darling.
Yeah. So I got some, which are in the book. I have fantastic photographs of her, like as a baby, you know, in school, you know, as a young girl of 10 or 12.
Well, how fantastic that she's finally being celebrated.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I felt. Because
very important.
Up to now, she was just a name.
She's just an aside. She's,
yeah.
Oh, by the way, she was there too.
Yeah.
But she was a great contributor, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah. So I started with her. And then from there went on to those musicians who had come in the 1920s, who are all now gone, but I've tracked down their families.
Their relatives.
People like, their relatives. People like Jimmy Neary, like Pat Roach, Frank Thornton, Jimmy Donnelly, who was the father of Mary McDonough. Mary Donnelly, Mary McDonough was her married name. Coz T and all of these. And then also children of immigrants from Ireland who were playing around that time, and two good examples would be Johnny McGreevy, who was born in Chicago but of Irish parents, and same of Eleanor Kane Neary, the great pianist. So they were all playing around that time. So that's that section of the book, which covers more or less 1920 to the World War II, 1945. And then I go on to the people that I was actually interviewing, who came
the people that are here
after war, yeah, who are here. And
so you did the descendants, and then
unfortunately
you...
who are now gone. All of
nearly
all of them are now gone.
Look
know.
What you did.
Yeah.
They've been immortalized.
Yeah, and then the rest of the book. So, well, I should tell you at the beginning as well, the book starts really with Chicago and immigration. Rather, I didn't want to go straight into the musicians. So, you know, I wanted to put it in context. So I give the history of Chicago first. You know, Chicago grew from, do you know Tom O'Malley? Yeah, and Mary Ellen, two beautiful people, and both just passed away recently.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God, they gave me so much information, it was unbelievable. But so I start with Chicago and give a history of Chicago. You know, it started 1803, it was just a Fort Dearborn, that's all it was, and a fur trading with the native Potawatomi Indians. And between 1803 and the end of the 1800s, it was a huge city.
The city grew up.
Yeah.
And then
the
city burned down.
And the city burned down. And then within that 100-year period, what I wanted to document, and I have, is what was it within that 100-year period that drew immigrants to Chicago? Not necessarily musicians, but just immigration, first of all. And there were three major events. One was the Illinois-Michigan Canal.
Mm-hmm.
That was...
Work.
Work. It was all hand.
Mm-hmm.
They had to dig out
Laborers.
That canal.
Mm-hmm.
And that was practically all Irish. So mm-hmm.
A lot of people died digging that canal.
Oh, yeah. Illinois-Michigan Canal was the first one. Then the yards was the second.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the...
Stockyards.
The stockyards.
Mm-hmm.
They consolidated in 1865. And that was the messiest... Unbelievable
disgusting
job.
Disgusting job.
You could, no refrigeration, mm-hmm. no running water, mm-hmm. and here they were killing millions of
mm-hmm.
hogs and cattle.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so
amazing the more people didn't die.
The
hysteria
Irish
or whatever. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, the Irish.
And then the one you mentioned, the fire.
Mm-hmm.
That was the next one, you know. 1 mile wide, 4 miles long,
mm-hmm.
wiped out the city. No, a big part of the city. Mm-hmm. And after it, there was a massive building.
And they blamed it on Mrs. O'Leary.
They did, but she didn't do it.
Of course she didn't do it.
No. Mm-hmm. So that's what I have at the beginning of the book. Just an idea on why immigrants came to Chicago. And then I have two examples of what it was like to immigrate. The actual experience of immigration. And they're 100 years apart. So I have one family that I interviewed who are descendants of a family who came from County Clare right in the middle of the famine, 1847. Oh, God. And they had the whole history, which I have in there. And then I give 100 years later.
You're lucky because a lot of people just wanted to forget about it.
Oh, I know. But they had the whole history, which was wonderful. And then 100 years later, an example of what it was like to emigrate. In the 1900s, late 1940s, and it's Tom O'Malley's story, which is fascinating. Mm-hmm. He sat down with me one day and told me the whole story, which again, so that's, you know, the first part of the book is really why immigrants came to Chicago, the city of Chicago, why immigrants came to Chicago, and then what was it like to experience immigration. And then I go from there to specifically talk then about the musicians. So the next two sections are the 1920s, the 1940s, and then 1940s to the present day, really. And then the rest of the book, there's three or four other sections in the book, are milestones that occurred here in Chicago related to Irish music that were specific to Chicago, but they had a national impact. And the first one is the IMA, the Irish Musicians Association. There was never a national association of Irish music in America ever until 1956, and it happened here in Chicago. And it was Frank Thornton who brought a whole group of musicians from New York, St. Louis, Philadelphia. He brought them all into Chicago, and they spent a whole weekend in a hotel in Chicago, and the outcome of it was a national association of Irish music.
And what does that do?
And they all went back. They all went back to their
homes,
specific homes, and they set up the North American, or the New York IMA, the Philadelphia IMA, and their vision was to promote, teach, and keep alive the tradition of Irish music.
So that's their mission statement.
That was their mission statement. And that was formed here in Chicago in 1956.
1956.
Yeah. So that's one section of the another section of the
book. This is why Chicago is considered the epicenter of traditional music.
Absolutely,
in North,
and quite rightly so. Mm-hmm. The next one was the Flacules. That time in 1951 in Ireland, Coltis was formed. And they had an annual, what they called a Flacule, which was a gathering for a weekend initially, then weeks of music. And in 1964, the IMA, which was the Chicago branch of the IMA, they decided we're going to have a Flacule.
Here?
Here in Chicago. And it was the first time first time in America,
outside of Ireland,
that anyone had a Flacule. And there were 1964, 1965, and 1966.
When would you say that Irish music was considered an art form by the general people, not by Irish people now? And a lot of Irish people dismiss traditional Irish music as diddly diddly.
Yeah, an awful lot wanted to kind of get away from their roots in a way. They wanted to be more modern, more
American.
Yeah, more American. They liked to go move into the jazz and the hip hop or whatever years they were in. So they kind of looked down on it. But thankfully, there was a whole group who held on to it. And sometimes, you know, just in the music sessions in their homes, but it thrived.
Do you think it's because of the formation of these institutions
that helped
made it as a recognized art form?
I do. That helped, without a doubt, that helped greatly. Really, and it helped promote it. And they made a record, and then that went out, and you know, to general distribution, an LP at the time as it was. So yeah, without a doubt, that was it. So it was the Flacule, the formation of the IMA, and then the third section is on tours. In 1959, Frank Thornton got a group of American-born Irish traditional musicians, singers and dancers from Chicago, and he brought them back to Ireland, and they toured Ireland for a full month. And in that full month, they did 23 concerts in 28 days.
Oh.
And I have the whole history of that tour, and that was an amazing tour, because at that time in Ireland in 1959, I mean, the music was still traditional
regional.
Music.
It was regional.
Oh, yeah,
very
it was
regional.
held on yeah. in the country. Mm. But in the cities, not so much. Mm. But that tour was an unbelievable success. And I have, in the book you'll see, I have reviews in all of the local newspapers, you know, if they were in Listowel or in Cavan or Belfast, or all the newspapers were raving over this. All the concerts were packed out. It really kind of gave Irish music in Ireland a massive boost. You know, and
right,
that's
sure.
You had to
leave the country in order to appreciate it.
Exactly.
Well,
and that was a big event.
Well,
so that's what I have in there as well.
Yeah. As you know, as they say, the Irish here are more Irish than they are in Ireland.
In Ireland, yeah. So that kind of sums up the whole book.
Well, here's the thing. You're a food scientist.
Yeah.
And you wrote a big book on Irish music.
Yeah.
And you are an investigator. You're an historian. And you are a documenter.
Right. And I have one more big mission to do.
What is it?
I should have told you I'll be retiring from my official job in a couple of months.
Congratulations.
I retired.
Are you waiting at the end of the year?
Yeah, I retire in December.
Congratulations.
Yeah, but while I was
retiring young enough to enjoy everything.
I hope so.
Absolutely.
But while I was, the 10-year period that I was, you know, interviewing and researching.
Ultimately. 10 years it took you to do this.
Ten years, yeah. Because, like, I have a full-time job.
Sure,
so this
and
was
you have family.
This was just, I had family.
You have games to go to.
Absolutely,
and
schools
school
and
things
parties.
To attend.
Oh, yeah. So this was just
and life to live.
This was just a pastime. Well, it is a pastime anyway. But
it's a passion, though.
But it was a labor of love, without a doubt. Oh my God! But I only could get to it on weekends and some evenings, and so that's why it took so long. But what I'm coming to is, those people that I interviewed and the families of the previous generations that I never got to meet, an awful lot of them, everyone kind of bought into my mission, which was really just to capture and record. And they gave me an awful lot of
material.
Recordings, photographs, manuscripts, books. I have built up an archive.
And they don't want them back?
No. And
it's a take them.
Yeah,
we don't know what to do
actually,
with them.
And actually, like, that was quite
a... Oh, I know where we're going.
So I have...
Your next thing is...
I've created a website.
A website, but... Are you doing a physical...
No. But what I'm doing is, I've created a website, which, and the website exists already. It's Richie Piggott, just my name, richiepiggott.com. And so you can actually buy the book from the website.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm as part of that website, I'm going to have an archive. And I'm uploading all of the recordings, all of the music,
fantastic.
All of the manuscripts.
I thought you were going to say that you are getting a storefront and doing one of those little museums. So we have
Well, come on now. Maybe.
One of those little unique places that we have in the city of Chicago.
Yeah.
These little archives, museums, places where a very unique interest, although I'd say this is a wider interest than you probably realize, but I do like the fact that there'll be some place to go.
Yeah, that's why
especially
I'm
Especially with the music and everything.
Exactly. That's why I'm putting it up on the website. So it's there because I feel like I don't own this. I mean, you know.
Oh, it's everybody's. It belongs to everybody.
I'm the curator of it at the moment, but I want to share it with the world, our people who are interested in it, you know.
Oh,
so that's what I'll be doing from next year on, you know.
That's amazing, though.
That's my big task.
That's a plan.
Yeah,
that's a project.
That's
that a project.
It's a big project.
I think it's going to lead
but
to
But I've already started it, and I'm looking forward to it.
It's going to lead you places you have no idea.
Mm.
I promise you. I mean, you think this loved you. I mean, it's going to be crazy. Absolutely. This is a book for me? Am I keeping this
Absolutely,
book?
Absolutely, yeah. So I didn't know whether you had it or not, but no. I said I'd bring one up to give you if you didn't have it.
Oh, that's so nice. Thank you. This is great. Yeah. Well, the thing is, I know the O'Malley's. Tom O'Malley did our basement in our house.
Oh, really?
He did, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, such a beautiful man. And Mary Ellen.
Such a gentle person, Mary Ellen. Oh, yeah, gorgeous. They're so nice. And how many kids they have?
10.
10, yeah.
There's a photograph in there of the whole family. There they are.
There they are. Yeah. So he would bring the boys to help him with the basement.
Yeah. Well, Brian took.
Did he take over the business?
Yeah. Brian started doing kitchens and
They would just trash their not in a bad way, but tease trash.
Yeah,
kids.
Yeah, yeah.
Like so, Mary Ellen was at this Tupperware party and she bought one of those. Well, maybe you're not familiar, but they had these pitchers. Okay. And it had a suction top that you put in, okay? And it's supposed to keep everything fresh.
Right.
Well, she decided to use it for coffee.
Oh.
It exploded all over the place.
Yeah.
I don't know why that story just tickles me, but it really does.
They're a wonderful family.
Wonderful family. Well, I think this is probably it for our podcast interview, but now I'm going to have you up to the show.
Oh, I would love to join you.
I think you'd be a great guest. We've been talking to
you.
We've been speaking with, I've been speaking with, Richie Piggott, who created this, what would we call this? Not a book, really. What is it? It's a history of the Irish musicians in Chicago, 100-year history from 1920 to 2020. And the name of the book is Cry of a People Gone.
A lot of people actually ask me about the title.
Because they're not, everybody's not gone.
No, and
why did you choose that title?
If you go to the front, mm-hmm. While I was doing it, while I was actually writing, when I eventually started writing to write the book, people were asking me, what do you want to call the book? And I didn't have an idea. I said, look, I'll know when I see it, but I don't know what I'm going to call it. And I read that poem, and the last line just jumped out at me as so beautiful. And
do you want to read it?
I know, sure.
Read it out loud.
Sure. This is a poem that's written by Donal O'Shiachán. Donal was a wonderful poet from the Slievedhuacha area of Kerry. And he was a poet and a folklorist. He wrote books on the folklore of the region as well as poetry. I didn't know him at all, but my brother Charlie knew him very well.
So he's a modern poet.
Oh yeah. Well, he's dead now. He died about 5. But a modern poet.
But still
yes.
A modern poet.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
This is not a Keats or anything like.
Oh
that.
No. He's definitely a modern poet.
Okay.
And when he passed away, his wife, Dr. Patricia Hearn O'Shiachán, published a wonderful book of his collected poems, and it was nice because the book was segmented into books or poems on the weather or poems on, but there was a section poems on music. So, and Charlie, I love poetry. I have a large collection of poetry books.
My God.
So Charlie knew that, and he said, there's a new book out, and he sent it to me. And of course, when I saw it and I saw the sections, I went straight to the music. And this poem, Donal O'Shiachán wrote for Michael Russell, and I knew Michael Russell. Michael Russell was a great traditional Irish musician from County Clare. Wonderful, wonderful man. A store of great tunes. He mainly played the tin whistle, but he was a great character, great storyteller as well. And I found out later that Donal O'Shiachán knew him very well. And when he died, and he died unexpectedly, he died in a car crash, Donal went to his funeral, and on the way home from the funeral, he wrote this poem.
He penned the poem.
Yeah.
I'm going to move this closer to you.
In honour of Michael Russell. So the poem is called The Soul of Clare, because that's where Michael was from, and it's for Michael Russell. Just two verses. He shambled in from a Doolin mist to O'Connor's pub in Clare. Made his way to a seat with easy grace, the centre of all things there. He bowed his head to a fiddler's tune and swayed with the draw of the bow, till the mood of the music held him too, and he sang out soft and low. He sang of a people old and proud in the grip of a terrible fear, when hope was flung in a famine grave with all that they held dear. And the fiddler's music trailed away, leaving only the sound of the song, and Michael singing the soul of Clare and the cry of a people gone. Isn't that brilliant?
Beautiful.
Beautiful. And the reason it jumped at me was the cry of a people gone was a couple of reasons, really. One was because of the book, as I said earlier, it's all about immigrants and it covers immigration. And immigration was miserable. It was sad for the immigrants. It was sad for the people they were leaving behind.
Oh my God, so Ireland had to, they started a children's allowance to make sure people stayed.
Absolutely. So that was the cry. You know, they were all crying. But then the word cry is also the sound, like you hear the cry of the curlew. It's the sound they make. You know, and it fitted beautifully with the immigrants that I was particularly interested in, because their cry was their music. So I thought the whole thing just came together beautifully.
Very evocative.
And that's why I...
Of your book.
That's why I chose the book, yeah.
Very
the
good.
Title of the book.
Title of the book.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's a great story all by itself.
Sure. Thank you.